牛津书虫配套英文朗读 MP3 第五集一，大卫科波菲尔，整理分享人一语风赖 QQ 号46469487 2，网站 www.mxlwq.com， 感谢您的支持。
Chapter 5David meets old friends again. I decided to go to London first, to stay at a hotel for a few nights, and see all the sights of that great city. I knew it would be very different from the last time I was in London, when I was working at the warehouse. Now, I was adult, and educated, and had money. The hotel I chose was called the Golden Cross, and because I looked so young,I was given a very small, dark room in the roof. But I did not feel confident enough to complain. That evening, I was returning from the theatre when I recognized someone going into the hotel. I could not prevent myself from saying at once, "Steerforth, do you remember me?" He stared at me for a moment. Then he cried, "Good heavens! It's little Copperfield!" I was so delighted to see him that I held both his hands, saying, "My dear Steerforth, you have no idea how pleased I am to see you again." I remembered how much I had admired him, and all my love for him came back. I had to brush away the tears from my eyes. "Don't cry, Copperfield, old boy," he said kindly. "I'm glad to see you too. What are you doing here?" "I've just finished school, and my aunt has sent me to London to look around before deciding on a profession. What about you, Steerforth?" "Well, I'm studying at Oxford University, but nothing exciting ever happens there. That's why I'm in London for a few days. But it's boring here too, isn't it?"
"In London?" I asked, surprised.
"I think it's wonderful. There's so much to do and see. I've just been to the theatre. The actors were excellent, and—"
David, laughed Steerforth, "it does me good to see your fresh, innocent face so full of excitement. Now, let me see. Which room are you staying in?"
"Number 44. It's rather high up," I confessed, blushing.
"They've put you in number 44? I'll soon change that."
And when Steerforth complained to the manager, I was immediately given a large, airy, comfortable room on the first floor, next to his. That night, as I fell asleep, I thought happily of the next few days, which Steerforth and I were planning to spend together. A week passed very quickly, with visits to the theatre, the museums, and the zoo. We went sightseeing, riding, swimming, and boating. Steerforth was the perfect companion to have, and I admired him even more than before. In fact, I loved him with all my heart. One day I said to him, "You know, Steerforth, I really must go and visit my mother's old servant, Peggotty. She was very good to me when I was a child."
"Yes, David, I remember you told me. She lives in Yarmouth now, doesn't she? Why don't we go there together?"
"Oh, yes, Steerforth. You'd enjoy meeting her brother and all the family. They're very kind, good people."
"Even if they are only working people," said Steerforth.
I looked quickly at him to see what he meant, but he was smiling at me, so I knew he was joking, and I smiled too. We travelled to Yarmouth by coach, and when we arrived, Steerforth stayed at the hotel while I went to Barkis's house to find Peggotty. When I knocked at the door, Peggotty opened it, and did not recognize me for a moment. I had continued to write to her regularly, but we had not seen each other for 7 years, and I was no longer the small boy she remembered. But when she realized I was her Master David, she sobbed and sobbed with delight, holding me in her arms, as she had always done. Soon she was calmer, and we talked about the events of the last few years. I heard that she was very happy with Mr. Barkis, who, however, was ill in bed at the time. She was so pleased to see me that she insisted I should sleep at her house during my stay in Yarmouth, in the little bedroom she had always kept for me. The next day I took Steerforth with me to visit Daniel Peggotty. It was a dark and windy winter evening. As we came closer to the old boat, we heard happy voices and laughter inside. I opened the door, and suddenly I was surrounded by Daniel, Ham, and Emily, all looking very surprised.
"Look! It's Master David!
Look how he's grown!"
And for a moment we were all shaking hands and talking and laughing at the same time. I did not forget to introduce Steerforth. They welcomed him warmly as my best friend.
"Well," cried Daniel Peggotty, his large face red and shining with delight, "it's wonderful, Master David, that you two gentlemen have come here tonight of all nights. That's the best night of my life, because tonight, gentlemen, my little Emily,"
and he took Emily's small white hand in his rough red one and placed it on his heart,
"has agreed to become Ham's wife."
"I congratulate you with all my heart," said Steerforth politely to Ham, without taking his eyes off Emily, who was blushing prettily.
"Master David knows how I love this girl," continued old Daniel, "and my dearest wish was for her to have a good husband to take care of her. And there's no one I trust more than Ham. He's only a rough sailor like me, but he's honest and sincere, and I know she'll come to no harm while he lives."
Meanwhile, Ham was blushing too. I did not know what to say, unsure whether I still loved Emily and was therefore jealous of Ham, or whether I was glad they were going to be happy together. But Steerforth always knew the right thing to say, and with a few well-chosen words he made us all feel much more comfortable. We spent the rest of the evening very pleasantly, telling stories and singing songs, and it was midnight when Steerforth and I left the old boat.
"Well,"
said Steerforth to me as we walked across the sand in the cold night air, "what a lovely girl, and what a coarse young man she's engaged to." I was shocked by these unexpectedly cold words, but when I turned to him and saw him smiling, I replied warmly,
"Ah, Steerforth, you pretend to laugh at people who are poorer or less educated than yourself, but I've just seen you spend the whole evening with the Peggotty family, making them happy. I know you understand and love them, and I admire you all the more for it."
He stopped and looked at me, saying rather sadly, "David, you're serious, aren't you?"
"I wish I were as good as you."
For the next 2 weeks, I was often with Peggotty and Barkis, while Steerforth went sailing or fishing with Daniel and Ham, or found other things to do, so I did not see very much of him. Finally, we decided to return to London. While we were travelling back on the coach, I turned to say something, and was surprised to see how miserable he looked.
"Oh, David," he said unhappily, "I wish I could control myself better. I hate myself sometimes."
"Steerforth,
what can you mean?" I cried.
"You're the best, the most intelligent, the kindest of men."
"Thank you, David," he said, shaking his head. "But you don't know how bad I am."
"Bad?" I repeated. "My dear Steerforth, don't say that.
I know your character well, and I'm proud to call you my friend."
In a little while his mood changed, and he became cheerful again. I soon forgot his words, but I remembered them later. In London, I discovered that my aunt had arrived at the Golden Cross Hotel, and had booked a room there for several days. We were delighted to see each other, and had a long conversation that evening. She had come to ask me a particular question.
"David," she said very seriously, "I've been thinking about your future profession. How would you feel about becoming a lawyer?" I thought for a moment. "Well, Aunt, it sounds a very good idea. I confess I hadn't considered it before, but I think I'd like it." "Very good," said my aunt, jumping up. "In that case, let's go immediately to see Mr. Spenlow. He's a partner in an important law firm, and I think he'll agree to train you. We'll have to pay him, of course, but after several years you'll be a properly trained lawyer and be able to earn your own money." And so we carried out this plan. My aunt paid Mr. Spenlow's firm £1,000, and I promised to work hard and do my best to become a successful lawyer. Before she returned to Dover, my aunt rented a small flat for me at the top of a house near the law courts, and I moved in at once. At first, it seemed very exciting to walk through the busy streets after a long day in the courts or at Mr. Spenlow's dusty office, and know that I had my own home to return to. But when I had climbed up all the stairs and entered my sitting room, it no longer seemed so exciting. In fact, my flat looked empty and depressing. So, after 2 days of loneliness, I was very glad to receive my first visitor, Steerforth, and, because I was so happy to see him, I invited him and 2 friends of his to dinner the next evening. As it was my first dinner party, I did not know what to buy, but I ordered cooked dishes of chicken and fish from the restaurant, bought cheese and fruit from the market, and had a large number of bottles of wine delivered. I was quite frightened by how much money I had spent. But when Steerforth and his friends arrived, I soon became more cheerful. The party was a great success, and we all enjoyed ourselves very much. We ate and drank and smoked and drank again. I was constantly opening bottles of wine and became unusually talkative. I began to feel rather strange, and when I caught sight of myself in a mirror, I seemed very pale. I had to confess to myself that I looked drunk. Someone suggested going to the theatre, and in a kind of mist we left my flat and walked through the streets. Steerforth was holding my arm and laughing. Then a man in a little box looked out of the fog and took money from somebody. Soon we were sitting high up in a very hot, very crowded theatre. There were bright lights, and there was music, but I could not understand what anyone was saying, and the whole building seemed to swim in front of my eyes. Then someone suggested going to visit some friends in another part of the theatre, so we went downstairs. Suddenly I saw quite clearly Agnes Wickfield, sitting with a lady and a gentleman. She was looking at me with a surprised expression on her face. "Good heavens!" I cried. "Agnes, you're in London!" "Quiet," she whispered. "People are trying to listen to the actors. You'll disturb them." Then she added kindly, "David, please do what I say. Ask your friends to take you home." I'd always taken Agnes's advice, and I did so this time. I do not remember how I got home, but I do remember Steerforth helping me to undress and get into bed. What a terrible, sleepless night I spent. How ill I felt. How dry my mouth was. But the next morning I felt even worse. I was so miserable and ashamed that I had been so stupid, and that Agnes had seen me drunk. I could not even apologize to her, because I did not know where she was staying in London. I spent the whole day with my head in my hands, in my dirty,
smoky room surrounded by empty wine bottles. But the next day a note was delivered to my flat. It was from Agnes, asking me to visit her at the house where she was staying. I went straight there after my day's work at the office. She looked so quiet and good, and reminded me so much of my happy school days in Canterbury, that I could not help crying.
"I'm so sorry, Agnes," I said, "that you saw me like that. I wish I were dead."
"David, don't be unhappy," she said cheerfully. "You know you can trust me, and I'll always be your friend." I took her hand and kissed it. "Agnes, you're my good angel." She shook her head.
"No, David. But if I were, I'd warn you to stay away from your bad angel." "My dear Agnes," I cried. "Do you mean Steerforth?"
"I do, David," she replied, looking firmly at me.
"Agnes, you're wrong. He is my trusted friend. He helps and guides me. It wasn't his fault that I got drunk, you know."
"I wasn't thinking of that. I judge him from what you've told me about him, and your character, and his influence over you." Agnes spoke very seriously, and her words went straight to my heart. "I'm certain I'm right. You've made a dangerous friend, David, because you're so trusting. Please remember what I say, and forgive me for saying it."
"I will, if you forgive me for getting drunk."
Agnes agreed, smiling, and then said suddenly, "Have you seen Uriah Heep?"
"No," I replied. "Is he in London? What's he doing here?"
"I'm worried, David," answered Agnes with sadness in her beautiful eyes.
"I think he's going to be Father's partner."
I remembered Uriah Heep's oily smile, and how uncomfortable he always used to make me feel.
"What? That creature? He's so unpleasant. You must prevent your father from agreeing to it, Agnes."
Agnes smiled miserably. "My poor father has no choice. You know how unhappy he has often been. And, of course, you've seen him drinking. You see, he loved my mother very much. And when she died, he didn't care so much about his work. That's when he started drinking. Uriah's very clever. He knows all this, and he's been very useful to Father, doing all the work that Father had forgotten or didn't want to do. Father really needs Uriah now to keep his business going. And Uriah himself pretends to be humble and grateful, but in fact, he's in a strong position and is insisting on becoming a partner. Father is ashamed of himself, but he has to agree.
Poor Father. I'd do anything to help him. Anything."
And Agnes sobbed bitterly. I had never seen Agnes cry before. It made me so sad that I could only say helplessly,
"My dear Agnes, please don't cry."
However, in a few minutes she was calm again, and I was able to leave her, promising to visit her and her father in Canterbury very soon.